And now, it's the Florida Spectacular Podcast, hosted by Kathy Celestri. Find Kathy on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Celestri, CathySalustri, on Facebook at Celestri Kathy, and visit her website, greatfloridaroadtrip.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Well, welcome back to the Florida Spectacular. I'm Kathy Celestri, your host. And this week, our guest is Cynthia Barnett, who has just published a wonderful book called The Sound of the Sea, and it is about seashells. And thanks for being here, first of all, Cynthia.
Kathy, thanks so much for having me.
It seems like you've been working on this book for a long time. And I think people in this age of instant publishing think that it's just super quick to write a book, and it is not. I know from experience it takes years, and it must have been, how was it, 3 or 4 years ago, you reached out to me. You were looking for specifically seashell stories. Part of your book deals with, I think, the way we used to regard seashells. But I'm so glad to see the book come to fruition. I'm also glad to see that we've changed how we think about seashells, because I think it's in your book you mentioned that the books that you used to buy for shell collectors talked about boiling the animals to get them out. And I remember that. And now, of course, it's not what we do anymore. Hopefully, that's not what we do.
Yes. So I'll answer a couple of different things you commented on, Kathy. First, thank you so much for having me on. I love your work and your writing, and I'm excited that you have a podcast, and we are fellow Florida homers and fans.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
So it took me 6 years to write this book, and that's kind of ironic because I thought it would be my easiest book. I had written two previous books about freshwater crisis in Florida, and then nationally. And then my third book was Rain, a Natural and Cultural History. And that was pretty complicated to, you know, try and understand the atmosphere and weave together the stories of weather and science. And I thought, boy, seashells will be easy compared to all I had to understand when it came to the hydrological cycle. And boy, was I wrong about that. So
that's like, Cynthia, that's like when you're driving on the highway on a road trip and you go, man, we're making excellent time. And then the next thing you know, you're getting pulled over and there's a five-car pileup. Don't ever say that.
No, I know. Why did I say that? So these animals, the marine mollusks, they're just magnificent animals. They are so diverse. They have lived for half a billion years. They're incredible survivors. They, you know, there were more than 50,000 of them known, probably twice that many more or three times that many more unknown and unidentified so far. And so I had to learn about these animals. And then it really took me a long time to narrow down. I narrowed it down to the 12 seashells I would build the book around. I think when I communicated with you several years ago, I still hadn't figured out which 12 I would choose. This really took quite a long time.
Why 12?
Why 12? I had to cut it off somewhere. So when I started, I did a lot more research, for example, about oysters. And in the beginning, I thought oysters would be an important part of the book because part of this is a reflection on climate change and seashells as a metaphor to what's happening to the world around us. So I did a lot of research on oysters and many other seashells too. And ultimately, I decided, you know, there have been some great books out there about oysters. Mark Kurlansky wrote a book about oysters. Rowan Jacobson wrote a book about oysters. A friend of mine named David Berger wrote an entire book about razor clams. So a lot of that had been done in terms of marine mollusks as food. So at some point, I made the decision that I'll take 12 seashells that are more you know, seashells writ large, like shells that were really important to humanity, perhaps for aesthetic or other kinds of beauty and that kind of value, and, you know, shells that were a touchstone. And I essentially did that to draw in the audience. And still, look what I did. I wrote a 400 page book on seashells. So I'm not even sure what a good job I did narrowing it down.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at the shells, and you know, I have not finished the book. And towards the end, you talk about the giant clam. Now, I read The Soul of an Octopus by Cy Montgomery.
Yes.
And prior to reading that, I thought one of the most delicious things on the planet was octopus. And yes, from the day I finished that book, I've not had any more octopus. I don't think I ever will. Chapter 12 is a giant clam. I'm worried you're ruining some sushi for me here.
Well, so this is a really important question you're asking me. And the great irony of you asking me this, Kathy, is that I saw you in a sushi restaurant.
I know.
Recently. You and I both ended up at the same sushi restaurant in Tierra Verde after a book talk at Tampa Bay Watch. So
I did not eat any mollusks. I did not.
I did
that
not
night.
Either. But let me answer that question, because it's a really important question. So I grew up eating all kinds of seafood and every kind of seafood. And my father and I didn't write about that in this book, but I wrote about it in The Wilder Heart of Florida, which I think you may have also written a little bit about. So in Wilder Heart of Florida, I write about my father and I spearfishing in the Keys, gathering all the conchs we could gather for conch chowder. And, you know, my feelings about that now and my memory of that. And another thing that I write about in the book, I raised my own kids going scalloping in the Gulf of Mexico, which was a really important recreational activity for us. We always looked forward to scalloping each summer. So like you, I loved Cy Montgomery's Soul of an Octopus. You know, the more I learned about wild marine mollusks and other fishes in this book, the less I wanted to eat seafood. And I'll tell you, throughout the book, I just tried to be really honest as I dealt with that. And that is part of my approach here. You know, we are all here, humans together, trying to do our best. And how can we learn about seafood and learn about what's happening to the earth and make sustainable choices? And I feel that there are ways to do that. So as you read the book, you kind of see me and hear me struggling with some of these questions. And by the time we get to the end of the scalloping chapter, my kids and I are still scalloping, but we're not eating the animals. We're scalloping, we're having a great time, and we're taking pictures of the scallops. And we're taking all these really fun underwater pictures. And I can tell you that I have never eaten another wild scallop since I finished the research for that chapter. And it doesn't mean I don't go scalloping. It means I still go, and I really enjoy the grass flats and taking pictures and being part of that scene. But I think we can go out into the Gulf of Mexico and enjoy it without gathering, you know, 5-gallon plastic buckets full of wild animals. I really believe that we can live differently. I also love to eat Cedar Key clams, and I do eat Cedar Key clams, and they are, you know, they're sustainably harvested in Cedar Key and also elsewhere in Florida. They keep water clean. They're helping keep the Gulf of Mexico clean. They help inspire people in that part of the Gulf to not over-fertilize and pollute, to not build golf courses right on the coast, as has happened elsewhere. So I really came to believe that there are sustainable ways to eat seafood. And I hope by the end of the book, people are feeling that and that they don't feel preached at, because I think that too is important.
Well, I potentially have good news for you about scallops, but I'm not sure. Oh, I won't know next week. I won't know until next week, but next week, the guest on the podcast is somebody who works for the extension out at Port St. Joe. And they apparently have a little scallop project out there. So I'm going to find out a little bit more about it. And it's great. If it's something that could be sustainably harvested, I'm thinking scallops might be back in your life again. But I want to ask you too, are the individuals going out scalloping? Are the individuals like you, like your father used to collect the queen conch? Are those the reasons that the populations have suffered? And I only ask that because back in the 90s, I did public relations for the local utility, and we had a drought in 1999. And the director of our utility was on a different side of the fence than the Board of County Commissioners. Board of County Commissioners wanted everybody to cut back on their watering. And our director said, well, you know, I'd feel more okay with that if we actually could stop giving permits to build. Sure. Like those are the major users. And I wonder, and I'm asking you, I don't know.
Yep.
Because I know people can over harvest like crazy. The Toria in the very north end of the state in the panhandle is a great example of people bringing a very, very populated, I guess, species down to almost nothing. But I'm wondering how much of this is commercial fisheries not being sustainable that's caused some of this?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Florida had a commercial scallop fishery at the turn to the 20th century, and it did not last. The only people harvesting scallops for about the past century have been recreational fishers. That's not true in the northeastern United States, where there has still been a pretty vigorous commercial scallop fishery. When it comes to the queen conchs, again, there was a vigorous commercial fishery that lasted until about 40 years ago. The Fish and Wildlife banned the commercial harvest of queen conchs first, and then the recreational harvest of queen conchs. And even though those harvests have been banned for 40 years, the queen conchs still haven't come back. And so clearly, it's not only the harvest. It's not only the harvest. It's not only the pollution. It's not only warming and acidification. In all of these stories, it really is the way we live writ large, and no one thing. And I think that's an important thing to remember, that we can and we will have to kind of change the way we live with the oceans and the world, and get back into balance. So I don't think you can blame the commercial fishers or the recreational fishers. I will tell you a story about the net ban that I think is illustrative. You remember, was it 1990 that Florida banned commercial fishing nets?
Are you talking about the gill nets?
Yeah, the gill net ban.
Oh yeah, that familiar.
That was very much a campaign. That was a campaign of recreational fishers led by Florida sportsmen, which was a really brilliant campaign, and it worked. And Floridians banned net fishing, putting commercial fishers out of commission in many of our small fishing villages up and down the coast. The fish have not come back after the banning of the gill nets. The same fish that were imperiled at that time are still imperiled now because there is an intensity of recreational fishing too. So in many of these cases, it's not one or the other, but it's the combination of the way we live and the intensity with which we fish generally.
Well, humans are not good at moderation.
That's right. Especially when we feel so surrounded by abundance, right? When,
right, I mean,
yeah, the way we live, the way we live. I wrote about, and going back to the octopus for a moment, I looked back at, I don't know if you've read the scalloping chapter, but you'll have to read it before you interview the scalloping person, because it has a lot about attempts to restore scallops in various places. But in that chapter, I come across Yul Gibbons. I'm looking at his book now. It's called Stalking the Blue-Eyed Scallop. So you remember Yul Gibbons was this wild food writer who was sort of known. He was sort of known for his simplicity, you know, harvest wild watercress and wild rice and eat simply and, you know, grow your own food and scavenge your own food. Well, when you read that book, which was published in the 1960s, he is gaffing octopus in their holes on the coast of California to eat them. He has these elaborate recipes for bouillabaisse where you don't just use one shellfish, one fish, and one crustacean. A good bouillabaisse is three fishes, three shellfish, and three crustaceans. And it's just like we're surrounded by that type of thing, right? Abundance, wherever you go, these huge restaurant meals and menus. And there would be no indication if you went to a restaurant that anything is imperiled. So you're right. You're right. It's like hard to see where that anything is in trouble because of the way we live. But I think it doesn't have to be that way. And I think there's a way to help people appreciate what we have and to appreciate it with joy. And, you know, that's part of why I wrote this book. And I really hope that I can be a small part of that change.
Well, I mean, it's an incredible work. And just I like the narrowing it down to 12 shells. I want to ask you, when you're talking about the recipes, have you ever read Cross Creek Cookery by Marjorie Kennan Rollins?
Yes, I love Cross Creek Cookery.
Do you remember the Donax broth? And it was basically...
I do. I love that. And I just came across Donax broth in another work. It was from the Caribbean. I know I was interviewing... This is a book I read for my book. It's called Talking Tayano, and it's all about the Tayano people of the Caribbean. And the anthropologist who wrote this, Bill Keegan, I was just having coffee with him the other day, and he was telling me that the Tayano people, you know, ate a lot of those Donax, and we were talking about Donax broth. And he was saying, it's funny that we look back at indigenous people and say, wow, if they ate Donax, they must have been down on their luck. But really, he said, why would we think that? It's delicious. And they may have just really loved eating Donax and making that soup. So yeah, I met a lot of people. When we were kids, we called those coquina.
Yes, that's what... That's what coquina? Everybody called them, coquina. I saw the recipe and I had to look it up years ago. I'm like, oh, coquina shells. It's what we built all of our schools out of in Pinellas County for the longest time. The old Flamingo Lodge down at Everglades National Park. If you look, it's limestone. And I believe
I love it.
Coquina. It's now I used to have a saltwater tank. And I would get my water from the Gulf. I would go out. I had a part-time job on a boat. I would go out and get the water far enough out and I would catch things and keep it in the tank. And I stopped eventually because it's a lot of work not to kill things in a fish tank like that. But, I had starfish. I would get starfish and I would go crazy trying to get Donax because that's what starfish like to eat. And if you can't get that for them, you have to find other things. And I had a crab that was gravid, and anytime there were crab, I don't even know what to call them, to be honest, little crabs, the starfish would move. They would haul butt to get to it. So I would go crazy trying to find Donax for them. And it seemed like wherever I went looking for them on that day, I couldn't find them. It seems like
isn't that funny?
Yeah, sometimes they're all over the place. And
sometimes they're there and sometimes they're not there.
No.
And that, you know what I found, Kathy? That is true of so many seashells. I spent a lot of time in Sanibel for this book. And then later I brought a videographer with me to try to film a book trailer. And it was funny because sometimes you'll go and there'll be seashells everywhere or live animals everywhere. But sometimes it'll be all Florida fighting conchs, or sometimes it'll be all starfish. Sometimes it'll be all cockles. And when I brought the videographer, it was like all giant cockles, which aren't particularly photogenic. So that was kind of funny. But it all depends on what animals are out there in the Gulf at the time and, you know, kind of congregating together, and what storm swept them up and brought them to shore. It's a bit capricious to know what's going to be on the beach at any particular time.
Well, capricious to us. I feel like there's an order to it to them.
Right. I don't know
how much time you were at Tampa Bay Watch when you spoke. Shell key. It's not really a key anymore because we've done some work on some condos at the edge, and mysteriously the pass filled in, and now it's a public land that I'm pretty sure is going to be a private beach for some people. But it used to be you could go out there and you could pick up sand dollars that were the size of dinner plates. I'm not joking. I mean, they were huge, and they'd be prolific. And the part-time boat job I had years ago, we would take a boat out there with tourists for a 4-hour trip, and nobody wanted to go in the winter if it was cold. So I would always love the first trip after a winter with these people because it was like a virgin island.
Wow.
And you would find all these seashells and all these huge, huge sand dollars. And it was just this really beautiful thing right at the southern edge by Fort DeSoto. And, you know, now because people can walk to it, of course, that's never really a virgin island anymore.
Yes. Yes. But so, I remembered the point you were making in your first question that I didn't get to, Kathy. You were talking about how the ethos has changed. Like when we were kids, the children's shell books all had very explicit directions for how to kill the animal.
Bleach.
One children's book I found had a recommendation to throw them in an ant pile and let the ant eat them alive. I mean, can you imagine?
Oh my God.
And so the one nice thing to think about is how much our ethos has changed. You know, we're so down on ourselves as people, but look how much we've changed over time. Like we were slaughtering plume birds at the turn of the century. We were boiling mollusks alive and plunging them in beach. We don't really do that anymore. People tend to know to collect an empty shell instead of a live shell. And in a couple of counties, that's the law. So we do change, and we can change. And I think that's important for people to remember.
Yeah, and I think those who either don't know or don't care, there's a little bit of peer pressure too, because I have seen people on the beach approach people who are collecting live shells
and kind of confront them,
which I mean, in today's temperament, I'm not sure that's wise. I guess you can tell if somebody's got a gun on them in a swimsuit, though. But I've seen people... You know, it's kind of harassed people. Hey, you've got to throw that back. You can't take live shells. Yeah. There's an animal in there. And that's helpful too, because I think some people don't realize that what they're doing is a potentially destructive behavior that has far-reaching impacts.
That's right. And there's also a tipping point when the majority of people change. And I did some research about this on lawn watering when I was working on my second book, Blue Revolution. There was some sociological research that looked at California lawns and native landscaping. And there's a time when just a few people do it, like just a few people switch out their lawn. And then once 75% do it, then everybody switched. And it was very much it was very much peer pressure. And that's what's happened here with lawns too. Like the green lawn is still king in Florida, but increasingly neighborhoods are interested in native landscaping. And I think young people, young families, at least here in Gainesville, it's often the young families who are doing really neat vegetable gardens in their lawns and, you know, just switching things up. And so these things do change over time.
Well, it takes time. Lawns were not, and you know this, and I don't know why I'm even saying this to you other than our listeners might not know this. Lawns are not what America was founded on. That was a relatively recent, I think it was Olmsted. It was a recent invention that we bring over these European lawns.
That's
and they're
right.
They're horrible. I think every city and county in Florida should have a law that no public property will be turf grass. But I have thus far been unsuccessful in convincing my local councilman to do that. But it takes time. I think we'll get to a point where we think about things more gently and we think about things more wholly. And I think books like yours definitely help us. Like, I mean, it's like Soul of an Octopus. You don't think about it.
Yes.
It's the damage we do unthinking.
Right.
So
right.
Let me ask you, cause I wanted to lead with this, but I didn't cause I got distracted with you. What was the impetus for this book? What made you go, I really want to write about seashells?
The impetus was a visit to the Bailey Matthews National Seashell Museum in Sanibel Island. Bailey Matthews, which is a wonderful shell museum, had invited me to come give a book talk. So I went and I was completely fascinated by the museum. I was born in Lee County, so I'm from that part of the world. And I love the museum, but it was a specific statistic that I learned while I was there. They had surveyed visitors to find out how much their visitors already knew about seashells. And most of these people who did the survey were tourists to Florida visiting with children. 90% of those surveyed didn't know that a seashell was made by a living animal. Most people thought they were stones or rocks. And I was so disturbed by that. And also, you know, just so moved by it in some way, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I think that very night was when I decided to do this book. I thought it said so much about our culture and where we are if a child or even a tourist to Florida doesn't know that a seashell was made by a living animal. And it struck me that that is the perfect metaphor for our relationship with the oceans themselves. Just like we've loved seashells for the beautiful exterior rather than the life inside, we love the oceans as this kind of beautiful backdrop of life or postcard without understanding what's happening in the oceans, namely the warming and the acidification, but also the pollution, which you are all really seeing that now in the Bay Area with the fish kills. But normally we don't really understand all the harm that's happening in the oceans. And so I just really thought about seashells as these great ambassadors to help people understand what's happening in the world around them, because they really are, I think they might be the most beloved object in nature in terms of objects people just love to hold and collect. And it seemed to me that they would be a good way to tell the story.
Well, and it's, I think you're right. It goes to your first chapter with the Neanderthal girl collecting the shells of a certain type. And yeah. I don't know this, but I would think that in most homes in the United States, there's probably a seashell of some sort. I may have an overabundance, but I use those giant, I think they're the caco shells, the big scallop shells.
Yeah.
I use them as spoon rests. They make the perfect spoon rest.
Oh, you do. That's a good new use for me. I've got mine as soap dishes.
They're also good for soap
in my
dishes.
In my younger and wilder days, they were ashtrays.
Ashtrays. I was I always say that writers, maybe not writers who teach at a university, but writers without their PhDs, until they really start to get some traction in their career, they take a lot of part-time jobs. And one of my part-time jobs was I was a bartender and also a server. And we used, they weren't scallop shells as ashtrays, but that's where I got the idea that you could use a shell as a functional thing, which obviously people knew way before us. I mean, before we got so civilized, we knew what to do with shells.
Some of those Neanderthal cockle shells had been used as cosmetic cases or some sort of pigment cases. Some kind of powder was kept in there that was used to color things. So that was interesting. But yes, I agree with you. I think almost everyone has at least one shell stashed somewhere. And I was thinking about that too, because I have shells around here that I just have never been. I'm not even a shell collector. And I've got shells in my house that I'm just unable to throw away because my children collected them when they had tiny hands. And now my kids are teenagers and I just can't throw them away. And I'm sure that's the case in other homes throughout this world.
I think that's more of a memory collector than a shell collector,
it is.
Which is what I think. I'm not a shell collector, but right now I'm looking at a lamp in my office that is a clear glass lamp that I have filled with seashells.
Yes.
But I think part of that is if you spend enough time outside in Florida, you run across things of beauty.
Yes.
And let me ask you, if it's a dead seashell, if it's just the shell, there is no live animal in it, what's the harm in keeping it?
Yeah, so that's a great question too. And I can't believe how often young people ask me that and really worried, like they're worried about taking even one shell because they know how much harm has been done to the world and they don't want to contribute to it. And sometimes people will say, well, don't the hermit crabs need the empty shells, you know, to trade around and to find their new place to flip? And what I say is, yes, take a seashell or take a few seashells, especially if you have a child with you, because that seashell is an important memento and an important memory of the beach. But I do wish people wouldn't take all the seashells on the beach. Like I mentioned to you that I spent a lot of time in Sanibel for this book, and sometimes I would take the kids with me. So when I started the book, they were a lot younger and I would want to take them shelling. But if you're with kids on vacation, they don't wake up until about 10 o'clock in the morning. And so by the time we got out to the beach in Sanibel, all the good shells would be gone because the collectors would have been out at 5 a.m. and just get everything. And I wish people wouldn't do that. I think there's a way to collect a few shells without taking every single thing that a child may like to find later in the day.
So two things about that. One, I used, like I said, I had a saltwater tank. Hermit crabs are jerks. They're giant, giant jerks. I had one that would kill smaller or larger crabs. I called him Tank Boss. He would kill other things. He would switch shells. I swear to you, Cynthia, it was a 55-gallon tank. He would do a victory lap around the tank in that shell and then switch back to his other shell. So we probably don't want to kill
them
all.
Are you serious?
He was a jerk. Wow. He killed my starfish. He was bad. He was a very, he was like a Ted Bundy of
shells. I have to say, I love hermit crabs. And I don't know if you've ever seen this behavior, but my husband and his buddy were out fishing the other day and they took video of me when the hermit crabs, they have like a little parade. And they all trade shells. It's just hilarious.
Trading shells would have been okay. And I had other hermit crabs that were lovely, but this one guy, man, he was bad. The other thing I want to point out to people, though, that another reason to wake up early and collect those shells is there's a lot of things that you see on the beach when you're a shell collector. I was on the beach, Fort DeSoto, a few years ago, and it wasn't even that early. It was like 7. And we saw a park ranger and somebody, I think, from the FWC helping hatchlings, the turtle nest. So I got to see a bucket full of hatchling turtles that hadn't gotten out in time that they were saving. People who walk the beach to look for shells are also some of the best stewards. They really get a sense of how much plastic debris is on the beach.
They do. And they often are picking up the plastic.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yes. Definitely. So, I mean, there are a lot of really good reasons to walk the beach and look for shells, even if you probably shouldn't take them all.
I came to, like I said, I wasn't a collector myself, but I really came to appreciate the hardcore collectors who call themselves conchologists.
Of course they do.
They are really into it. And I will also say they really understand the science and the animals, and they often help scientists identify new species, and they really do a lot of good.
What's your next book?
Well, I think you're asking me a bit too soon.
Really?
Right now it feels very good to have finished this. It took me longer than I expected. I also have a really nice sense of completion in having finished the hydrological cycle. Like I said, I started with freshwater. I wrote my rain book. Now I've written about the ocean. And I feel like it's a series that I feel proud of and excited about. And so I feel like I can rest on those laurels for a little while. I will say that my first book, Mirage, will always be one of my favorite books. And I often think about updating it for its 20th anniversary. It was published in 2005, and it has very little of the climate change story. And because I wrote it in an epic drought, it is more about water supply than water quality. So I would like to update that book and write a bit more about water quality and a bit more about climate change, and maybe bring it out for a 20th anniversary edition. So I'm thinking about that. But for now, I need to sell a few copies of The Sound of the Sea.
Well, I am absolutely positive that will not be a problem for you. For our listeners, we are going to, of course, include links to all your books and ways that people can connect with you after this and let you know how much they loved your book. Or you know, the odd bad review that someone's having a bad day and you get a stupid review that has nothing to do with the book. Like, I thought this was about how to collect seashells.
Oh, yes. I try not to look at the Amazon and Goodreads reviews.
I don't think you should. I read enough of them to know that they're not usually based on the actual caliber of a book.
But Kathy, I will tell you, Amazon and Goodreads reviews are important to authors now. Crowdsourced reviews are becoming more important than newspaper reviews because people trust the wisdom of crowds. And so I often say, people are always asking me, where would you like me to buy the book? Where would you make more money? And actually, the author makes very little, no matter where. It doesn't matter. So I usually say, buy the book from your local independent bookstore, but then put a review on Goodreads and or Amazon, because that helps the author more than the actual purchase.
Yeah, I can't tell you. People would ask me that too. Well, where can I buy the book so you'll make the most money? And I'll say almost exactly that. It really doesn't matter. That's not where I make my money. I make my money off speaking. I make my money. Yes. I mean, yeah, you make a little, probably the first year you have a book out, you make money off of it. And then it's just a paycheck you get once a year or whatever. You're like, what is this for? Oh, okay. We'll put gas in the car, something like that. But, the reviews matter. Reviews definitely matter.
Reviews matter a lot. Matter a lot.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your afternoon to sit with us. And is there anything you want to mention we haven't chatted about? We're about out of time, but we always have a few extra minutes if we need them.
Oh, well, I'm just really happy to be on the podcast, and I appreciate everything you're doing. And you know, I think the Florida story is so much more complex than we get credit for nationally. So I just love to see, I feel like there's kind of a resurgence of Florida culture, including literary culture. And I'm just thrilled to see it. And
well,
you're part of that, Kathy. So thank you.
Thank you. I hope so. I am getting, hopefully today, the final advance, whatever they call it, at the press for my next book, which is focused solely on why Florida is, well, the working title of the book is The Florida Spectacular. And every chapter is something about our state that deserves recognition. I mean, there's a lot of really good stuff coming out of Florida. And I think one of them is the writer. I mean, Jack Davis, who I believe is your writing partner.
Yes. Jack is my good friend. We both live here in Gainesville, and we both get to our desks by 5 a.m. And we have been, we've been writing partners for the last several years on these most recent books we've written. So,
well, I know he's told me in the past how much your reviews or your review of his work has helped. So if you hear this, folks, and you love Jack Davis's book, you should probably buy Cynthia's, because she's really what made it great, from what I understand.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thanks again. And, we will definitely continue to fight the good Florida fight on the podcast. Come back anytime you want.
Okay. And I made this offer to Craig too, and he's taking me up on it. But when your book comes out, if you want to turn the tables, I will interview you on your podcast about your new book. How
Orange,
does that sound?
Let me ask, what do you teach at UF again?
I teach environmental journalism.
Okay. Then that, environmental is better than investigate. That's fine. Well, no, I think that would be great. I think that would be wonderful. And hopefully by this time next year, that's about where we'll be. Nothing moves quickly in the traditional publishing.
I know. Well, good luck with it, Kathy. Nice talking with you.
Great talking to you too. Thanks everyone for joining us this week on the Florida Spectacular. We'll see you next time.